We will begin the next argument, Geringer v. Strong. It is case 17-4190. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, I'm George Hoffman. I'm appearing on behalf of my client, Robert Geringer. The district court order below granting summary judgment against my client should be reversed for two reasons. It made two mistakes. The first mistake was its application to the merger doctrine under the, or parole evidence rule, under the unusual circumstances of this case, where the second contract became void. And its second mistake was applying tort-like causation principles to the well-established contractual law of conditions. It's black-letter law that a party cannot cause the failure of a condition in a contract and then use that failure of the condition as a defense in a subsequent breach of contract case. That's exactly what Appellee D. Ray Strong has attempted to do in this case. So, based on these two legal reasons, the court should reverse and remand. And I'll address the errors one at a time. The first error of the district court was in its application of the parole evidence rule. The court below applied the rule in a way that is directly contrary to what the party's contract said. But not only that, it erred in its application of the applicable legal principle, which is contained in the Restatement of Contracts, Section 213, Sub 3. Now, the case involves two contracts. The first was called a Memorandum of Understanding. I might refer to that as an MOU from time to time.
And is this a term agreement?
I'm sorry?
It's referred to as the term agreement?
Well, the parties refer to it in different ways.
Well, I want to know for sure what you're talking about. Are you talking about what they refer to as the term agreement?
What the court below referred to?
Whoever referred to it.
It's been referred to inconsistently, which is why it's the title of the document is Memorandum of Understanding.
Are they the same thing, I think, is what Judge Kelly's
right.
asking you.
They are. Yes. So there's the Memorandum of Understanding is a two-page document. It was signed by the parties in May 2015.
Was it approved by the bankruptcy court?
It was not approved by the bankruptcy court. The Memorandum of Understanding had two conditions. One condition was the termination of a contract that Mr. Strong had to sell the property at issue, which is located in Smyrna, Tennessee, to a different party called Drapac. So Mr. Strong was under a contract to sell this Smyrna, Tennessee property to Drapac. And the Memorandum of Understanding said, as a condition, Mr. Strong will terminate that contract with Drapac within 5 days. And the second condition that Your Honor referred to was bankruptcy court approval. Those are the two conditions. Now, the second contract between the parties is called a land purchase agreement. And the land purchase agreement contained the exact same two conditions. Number one, the termination of the Drapac contract. And number two, the approval of the bankruptcy court. And it's undisputed that the bankruptcy court never approved the party's agreement.
Which party's agreement? Your client's agreement.
Correct. My client, Mr. Geringer, appellee, Mr. Strong.
Right.
And the land purchase agreement, which is the second contracted issue that did have an integration clause, had a specific provision that told the court what would happen if bankruptcy court approval did not happen. And that's Section 6A of the land purchase agreement. And it says, and I quote, if bankruptcy court approval does not happen, this agreement shall be null, void, of no force and effect. And if that were not clear enough for good measure, the contract goes on to say, and the parties shall be in the same position they were as though this agreement had never been executed. If the parties had not executed the land purchase agreement, they would be bound by the Memorandum of Understanding.
In the absence of bankruptcy court approval, it would mean nothing.
I'm sorry?
In the absence of bankruptcy court approval, that original MOU would be meaningless.
Well, the bankruptcy court did not approve the land purchase agreement.
They didn't approve the MOU either.
That is correct.
And they did approve the Smyrna sale that had earlier been entered into?
To DRAPAC, absolutely correct. So the bankruptcy court did not approve the MOU, and the reason it didn't approve the MOU was because the trustee never attempted to obtain court approval of it. But regardless,
was your client was a party to that bankruptcy proceeding, wasn't he?
My client is a creditor in the case. Okay. He has an allowed claim of nearly $250,000.
So he appeared in the case to make a claim.
Indeed, he filed a claim and it was approved by the court.
All right. Did he ever make any effort to submit this memorandum of understanding to the bankruptcy court?
No, that was the trustee's obligation under the memorandum of understanding.
All right. Do you have the MOU in front of you there? It's okay. Do you recall off the top of your head, does it specifically say it's the trustee's duty to present that to the bankruptcy court?
I believe it indicates it's subject to bankruptcy court approval, from memory, is what the provision says.
It definitely says it's subject to bankruptcy court approval, but it doesn't say who has to do it. I'm just wondering, I mean, at the point where presumably the land contract is void, and your client wants to hold up the MOU as a valid agreement.
That's right.
I mean, the other side didn't agree with that, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so couldn't your client have presented this document to the bankruptcy court and say, hey, this is the binding document, we want you to approve it?
The answer to that is no. And the reason is because bankruptcy trustees have certain specific rights and powers. Under Bankruptcy Rule 9019, bankruptcy trustees have the ability to ask the court to approve an agreement, a settlement.
So does a creditor.
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. I think trustees have the right. I don't think a creditor has the right to do that.
Of course they do.
But the question is, that's a condition to the contract, bankruptcy court approval, and the condition failed. And I think the question is, and thus becomes, why is it that condition failed? And the reason the condition failed is because when the trustee had the absolute right under his contract to sell this Smyrna property to DRAPAC, he had the absolute right to terminate it because of DRAPAC's failure to meet several due diligence milestones. And he was required to terminate it within 5 days. And in that 5-day window, he had the unquestioned right to terminate the contract.
Stop you there, because first of all, you've been saying that the trustee had the unqualified right, and basically all the trustee had to do is snap fingers and it was done. But the MOU doesn't even say that. It says the trustee will within 5 days provide notice of termination of the contract to DRAPAC, I guess. And then we're going to figure out whether or not it's allowed to terminate. In other words, the trustee isn't the boss. The bankruptcy court is the boss. And we know that when the trustee tried to terminate the contract, ultimately, the bankruptcy court said, no deal. I'm not terminating it. We've got a contract here. Why would it be any different whatsoever if the trustee had done the 5 days? The bankruptcy court would have said the same thing, unless you can tell me why not.
Certainly. So during that 5-day window, DRAPAC was in breach of the contract. There was an amendment that was negotiated by the trustee that both the trustee and his counsel have said, and correctly, he had the absolute unqualified right to terminate the contract in that 5-day window. The trouble is, by the time the trustee finally did actually attempt to terminate the contract, that was on June 30th, 2015. By that point in time, he had lost the right.
You're being very loose with the contract language, because I'm looking at the First Amendment to the agreement, March 11, 2015, and these milestones are not set in concrete. They're not, if you do not make this date, then the trustee has the right to terminate, I guess, no matter what the bankruptcy court says. Mm-hmm. Instead, it says that the buyer agrees to use its good faith, diligent efforts to pursue the following milestones. And then for each of them, there's a date and it says the buyer should reach conceptual agreement. The buyer should. So it's just not as hard and fast as you're presenting it, is it?
Well, then further on in that same provision, it says the trustee has the right to send notice of termination of the contract. And the trustee has said specifically in a declaration submitted to the bankruptcy court that he specifically bargained for the right to terminate the contract upon their failure to meet those due diligence milestones. So the reason the MOU says notice of termination is because that's the provision that Your Honor just referred to uses those words, notice of termination. This is in the First Amendment to the Smyrna contract. So by the time we get to June 30th, what DRAPAC does is they waive all due diligence the day before June 29th and announce that they're ready, willing, and able to close. Now, in that circumstance, with that set of affairs, clearly the trustee couldn't terminate the contract because they had waived all of the conditions. DRAPAC had waived all of the conditions to closing.
Well, how about the milestones? Had they been completed by June 30th?
They had not.
And so what is the difference? The bankruptcy court on the MOU treat termination different than it did on June 30th if the milestones were never met?
The milestones were not met when the parties entered into the MOU on May 20th. By June 29th, all of the milestones were either met or waived by DRAPAC. So it's a different set of affairs.
How does DRAPAC waive its own milestones? I mean, it's put in there for its benefit.
Well, that's probably an incorrect way of saying it. They didn't waive milestones. They had to meet certain milestones under the First Amendment to the contract.
Well, they had some due diligence requirements.
Correct.
And they waived their own due diligence requirements.
That's what I should have said, and I apologize.
And the agreement then was fulfilled.
The agreement was fulfilled. They said we're ready, willing, and able to close. And then what the bankruptcy court said is under that state of affairs, where DRAPAC said we're ready, willing, and able to approve, bankruptcy Judge Marker said, where I've got a party under a signed contract, I'm not going to permit the trustee to sell the land to some other party. And the only reason that state of affairs existed is because when the trustee had the right to send a notice of termination, which is acknowledged in the MOU, he failed to do that. And it's that failure to...
Didn't your client waive that, with an email saying that, hey, I understood the notice was going to go out after the land contract, and then somebody writes back and said, that's fine. And then the other thing is doesn't the execution of the land contract basically waive that breach?
Both great questions. So let me address the second one first. So the execution of the land the land purchase agreement's interesting. You won't find the memorandum of understanding referenced once in that document. What we're left with is section 6A of the LPA, which says if bankruptcy court approval does not happen, you're in the same grounds as if the contract had never been signed. And this brings up the restatement provision I mentioned before, the restatement second section 213 sub 3. And what that provision says in the first sentence of it, an integrated agreement that's not binding or that is voidable and avoided does not discharge a prior agreement. That's what we have here, is an agreement that is voided by its own terms and therefore it does not discharge the prior agreement.
Okay, but that's slightly different than what I'm talking about. So maybe the MOU does get to spring back into place, but there was a breach that was not acted on and was seemingly waived by the signing of this agreement that is now void. Is it your position that when the MOU sprung back into action, that the breach was still there ready for you to be able to act on then?
The breach was there, Your Honor. You referenced the email exchange. First of all, it's very unclear. It's one party saying to the other, there's an ambiguity in the agreement. We intend to send this notice within 5 days of signing definitive documents. Is that okay? And the response comes back in 3 minutes. I'm on a conference call. I don't understand this ambiguity.
No, I think it said fine.
It did say fine. You're absolutely right. It also says, I don't understand this ambiguity. I'm on a conference call. And it's sent within 3 minutes. For that to constitute a waiver of anything, well, the court below certainly didn't find that, and it would have been improper on summary judgment.
It's up to you if you want to reserve your time.
I'll reserve my last little bit. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Goldberg for Appellee Ray Strong in his capacity as trustee. Your Honors, despite the 100 or so plus pages of briefing and the complex factual background, this case hinges on two inherently simple issues of contract law. The first is that a later integrated agreement supersedes an earlier agreement covering the same subject matter. And the second is that a plaintiff alleging a breach of contract must prove that the alleged breach caused his damages. The district court correctly ruled in favor of the trustee on both of these issues. Starting with integration, there really can't be any dispute that this is a fully integrated contract and that the parties intended for an integration. An integration clause is conclusive proof of intent to integrate, and paragraph 19C here really couldn't be any more clear. It says that it's the settlement and sale agreement, or the land purchase agreement as Mr. Hoffman referred to it as, is the sole and entire agreement of the parties, and that all prior discussions, negotiations, and agreements are merged herein and have no further force and effect. There also can't be any real argument that the settlement and sale agreement and the term sheet cover the same subject matter. I know in Mr. Geringer's brief, they try and say that they're different, but I think we went in kind of painstaking detail how they both involve the sale of the same Smyrna property to either Mr. Geringer or a person making a higher and better offer. They're both for the same price, $2.25 million. After closing, the part to either Mr. Geringer or the person making a higher and better offer, the parties would exchange mutual general releases. Mr. Geringer would withdraw his objection to the Warwick settlement. And then importantly, both of the agreements were subject to the trustee's ability to terminate the DSS 3 agreement and bankruptcy approval of the settlement and sale agreement. So thus, under the merger doctrine, there can be no question that when the parties executed the settlement and sale agreement, the term sheet with its 5-day notice provision was merged and had no further force and effect.
Do you agree that when the bankruptcy court wouldn't approve the land contract, that agreement was then void?
Yes, under paragraph 6A.
Okay, so do you also agree that after that happened, that the memorandum of understanding became the operative document again?
No. After the contingencies in paragraph 6A of the settlement and sale agreement failed, a trustee was unable to terminate and the bankruptcy court didn't approve. The parties went back to not the term sheet or the memorandum of understanding, but they went back to the position of having no agreement at all.
Okay, so they went back to pre-MOU status.
Correct.
All right.
And this is because under the merger doctrine, once parties enter into a later integrated agreement, any prior agreements covering the same subject matter, they cease to exist. Once the merger happens, there's only one agreement.
So do you have any authority that says that's where the subsequent document has become void, and where a court has said that when that happens, even the merged document, you know, that it remains inoperative?
Yes, so that's the Alphonse Hotel case from the Second Circuit. There, the parties they entered into an oral joint venture agreement covering the development and leasing of a property, and then later entered into a formal lease agreement covering the same property and terms. The court held the later agreement was void, I think, for lack of consideration. And the court held that even it had an integration clause. And the court said, well, you don't go back to the joint venture agreement. You go back to no agreement at all.
Okay. So I think your opposing counsel would say that case is different because that was an oral agreement. Does that make any difference in your analysis that it was oral?
No. Under the parole evidence rule, there's no difference between a prior oral or written agreement. All the agreements are merged therein. And respectfully, this is really the only interpretation here that doesn't lead to an absurd result or completely read out the contingencies in paragraph 6A. It just can't be the case that when the settlement and sale agreement fails because the trustee couldn't terminate the DSS 3 agreement and the bankruptcy court didn't approve, that you go back to the same preliminary, unrefined version of the exact same agreement that has the exact same contingencies that caused the later agreement to fail. That's not how the law can work. Moving on to causation. It's Hornbook law that in order to succeed on a claim for breach of contract, a plaintiff must prove that the defendant's breach caused his damages. I want to say what this isn't an argument about. This isn't an argument that failure of a condition excused the trustee's performance. It's not an argument that the trustee did or did not breach the term sheet. And it's not an argument that Mr. Gehringer did or did not suffer damages. For this argument, we assume that the term sheet's the governing document. We assume that the trustee breached the term sheet by failing to give written notice within 5 days. And we assume that Mr. Gehringer suffered his alleged $14 million plus in damages. Even assuming all of this is true, Mr. Gehringer still had to provide some evidence linking the trustee's failure to timely provide notice to DSS-3 to his damages. To keep this thread, part of that was providing some evidence that it was the trustee's conduct that caused the conditions to fail. I know Mr. Hoffman just talked about how the trustee had, at the time that the party signed the term sheet, the trustee had the absolute right to terminate. This is absolutely untrue. As Your Honor mentioned, in the DSS-3 amended agreement, the trustee agreed to extend DSS-3's diligence deadline so long as DSS-3 worked in good faith and commercially reasonable diligence to meet certain milestones. And if they didn't work in good faith and commercially reasonable diligence, he had the right to terminate. Well, there's absolutely no evidence that DSS-3 didn't act in good faith and commercially reasonable diligent manner to pursue those milestones. Judge Marker in the bankruptcy court agreed that these weren't hard and fast requirements, and there just was no way that he could terminate based on those. Mr. Gehringer also ignores the notice and cure provision in paragraph 15.1 of the agreement that would have given DSS-3 the right to cure any potential breaches. So that leaves us then with the question of what facts are in the record.
What about DSS-3's request to reduce the purchase price?
They did ultimately request to reduce the purchase price.
Does that matter?
At the end of the day, no.
Well, what if the trustee would have said, we had an agreement, but now we don't have an agreement because you want a substantial reduction in the price, goodbye, and hello, Mr. Gehringer?
DSS-3 never actually demanded. And said, look, we're not going to continue to perform under the agreement if the trustee doesn't reduce the purchase price. And we know now, after the fact, the trustee learned that before DSS-3 made a request for the purchase price reduction, it had closed on the purchase of 3 adjacent properties. And we also know that every time the trustee made any mention of termination, DSS-3 acted in a consistent manner, emphatically resisting any efforts. So when the trustee first said in response to the price reduction, and we don't think it's in the party's mutual best interest to continue, DSS-3 says, no, we don't agree to any termination. We need to make this contract work. When the trustee sends formal notice, DSS-3 says, no, you can't terminate. There's a notice and cure provision, and the milestones were those of commercially good faith and reasonable diligence. He then sues the trustee in federal court in Tennessee, and then he vigorously opposes the sale motion. There's simply no facts that would support an inference that DSS-3 would have acted any differently had they been given notice any earlier. And what we have for how the bankruptcy would have acted is even more sparse. All we have is what Judge Marker said at the 2 hearings related to these issues. First, he agreed that the milestones in the DSS-3 agreement were those of good faith and commercially reasonable diligence. And second, he made it perfectly clear and continues to make it perfectly clear to the trustee that he didn't think it was a very good idea or a good choice to try and sell the property to another party when it was under contract to DSS-3. In short, Mr. Gehringer provides no facts, points the court to nothing, that would support inferences that either DSS-3 or the bankruptcy court would have acted any differently had the trustee sent notice of termination to DSS-3 sooner.
I want you to assume that the MOU sprung back into validity after the land contract was void. So assuming that occurred, was the MOU binding on anyone prior to bankruptcy court approval?
No, it was not.
Right.
Under 10th Circuit law, I think it's the Broadmoor case, it says that a contract with a trustee isn't binding until the bankruptcy court approves it.
Okay, let me ask you item number two. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that it had to be the trustee that presented the MOU for approval, or could Mr. Strong, or could Mr. Gehringer have
I believe Mr. Gehringer could have made a motion.
Okay.
Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I ask that the court affirm the holding of the district court. Thank you.
In the short time I've had, I'd like to address the last point concerning bankruptcy court approval. And I'll acknowledge there's a split of the case law on this topic. I think the Broadmoor Hotel case that was cited, the reference is to footnote one in that case. It's dicta. The better view of the law in the split, and it's taken by Collier on Bankruptcy, the foremost treatise, is that bankruptcy court approval is a necessary condition, but it doesn't prevent a contract from being fully binding before the court the court approves it. It's a contract, it's just subject to court approval. That doesn't mean it's not a valid contract binding on the trustee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Thank you for your comments.